rightly people. So when people who were part of your heart went lost in the world, the days were hard. The message awaiting him from Jane had brought new color into the sky. From county road to state route, he minded what little traffic passed him in the oncoming lane and kept an eye on any vehicle behind him, alert for anyone who didn't seem born to this territory. Because the truck had a GPS, the self-appointed masters of the universe who could use the full arsenal of modern technology didn't need to tail him as in those old detective novels and movies. But if they thought there was any chance that Jane might visit here for any reason, they would have people nearby who could swarm to snare her. Ansel and Claire assumed anything said on any phone, landline or cell, would be heard in real time or reviewed later. Any important issue they needed to address was now discussed out of doors. The Longrins lived 19 miles from Hawk Ranch, which in this part of Texas was just around the corner. Her mother died of cancer when Alexis was 14, and her dad drank himself into an early grave. Alexis and Chase inherited a broken-down farm. They sold the stock and a piece of the land. With a little cash and a lot of sweat, they turned the remaining property into a thriving horse operation, that breed called the National Show Horse, which combined the Arabian and the American saddlebred. Show-quality Tennessee walking horses and standardbreds for harness racing. When Ansel arrived, Chase was in his office, opposite the tack room in Stable 3. His blonde hair shone nearly white, his face burnt bronze by the sun. He got up from his desk, and they shook hands, and he closed the door. Ansel took off his Stetson, but didn't sit, eager to hear why Jane had called.
"She's on the road with 8 children," Chase said.
Ansel half thought he hadn't heard right.
"Children?"
"She sprung them from someplace they were being held. It's part of this thing she's tangled in. She'll tell you when she sees you."
Both alarmed and gladdened, Ansel said,
"She's coming here?"
"Not here, but close. She's hoping Leland and Nadine Sackett will take the kids off the record for the time being."
County born, Leland and Nadine had married at 19 and gone off to conquer Dallas. It would be foolish to say one was more an entrepreneur than the other. By 30, they were millionaires. Year by year, they compounded their wealth until, at 46, they grew tired of Dallas and bored with making money. They returned to their home ground and bought a half-assed dude ranch. Inspired by what Milton Hershey, the chocolate king, had done in Pennsylvania, they remade the dude ranch into a first-rate school and orphanage.
"I imagine Nadine and Leland will take them in quick enough," Chase said. "They never turn one away."
"Just so they know, dealing with Jane makes them accessories after the fact, if it's ever found out."
"When everything that's said about Jane is proved to be damn lies, we'll be accessories to justice. Anyway, it didn't stop me."
"Well, you and Nick had quite some history."
"Aren't Nadine and Leland Nick's godparents?"
"They are."
"Didn't they lose their boy to meningitis when he was 3?
"You know they did. And you know his name was Travis."
Chase smiled.
"Something tells me it's a done deal."
"When's Jane figure to get there?"
"Barring trouble, around 2 o'clock tomorrow afternoon. You want to leave your car in town, meet me somewhere, I'll drive you."
"If I learned anything from my daughter-in-law," Ansel said, "that wouldn't be cutting the rope anywhere."
"What rope?"
"The feds have a rope around me and Claire. We can't see it, but they can. Me coming here loops the rope to you, till they decide you don't connect with Jane. However we get to Sackett Ranch, we first need to snip the rope, so they can only follow it to the cut end."
"You have some idea how?"
"If I tell you, then the rope's not cut."
Chase's eyes widened.
"You have to think through everything, as if revenuers are living in your pockets?"
"Worse than them, son. The most the tax man wants is to strip you of everything you've ever worked for."
I guess I need to get my paranoid on. These days, it's best you be that way.
Chapter 8. The public spaces and grounds of the Iron Furnace Lake Resort feature numerous discreetly placed cameras to provide protection without suggesting to the guests that their privacy is compromised. All video streams are sent to a windowless bunker in the basement of the main building, where any of the technicians can summon views from any of the cameras, displaying them on large monitors that quarter the screen to present multiple simultaneous video feeds. As Booth Hendrickson stands fingering the card with the phone number for a private affair, Stacia Odell works efficiently with two of the security technicians to retrieve video recorded during the tour on which she took Martin Moses the previous day. He doesn't want to call the Atlanta number until he has seen the event planner. With one saliva-wetted finger, he has already discovered that the 10 digits of elegant calligraphy are not printed but are drawn by hand in ink. They smear. He is convinced that he will recognize Martin Moses, though he has never met anyone with that name. "Here we go," says Stacia Odell. Hendrickson joins her at a monitor as the technician at the workstation selects one of four views on the display and enlarges it to the full screen. Martin Moses is Luther Tillman. Chapter 9. The guy paying for takeout at the cashier's station in the restaurant in Rockford, Illinois, was one surprise too many. Long experience had taught Rebecca Tillman to be flexible, not in matters of principle, but in regard to the inevitable surprises, big and small, that this world of mysteries produced. Miracles and miseries were equally rare, but the ordinary unforeseen developments more often than not threw sand rather than oil in the gears of your carefully constructed life plan. One day earlier, she wouldn't have imagined any circumstances in which she would be behind the wheel of Robbie Stassen's 61 Buick station wagon, accompanied by her daughter Jolie, driving 9 hours before stopping for the night in Rockford, Illinois. She, the wife of a black sheriff, now in a town where one of the founders back in the 19th century had been a slave named Lewis Lemon. The three-story motor inn provided quality accommodations, the clean and spacious rooms opening off an interior corridor instead of directly onto the parking lot. Rather than use a credit card, she had paid cash, as Luther advised, although it had been necessary to provide a driver's license as identification. A windowed corridor on the ground floor connected the inn with the reception area, off which the front desk, bar, and restaurant were located. In the restaurant, as the hostess picked up two menus and prepared to escort the Tillmans to a booth, Jolie gripped her mother's arm hard enough to hurt. Startled, Rebecca looked at her daughter. With her eyes and a nod, Jolie indicated a man in his early 20s who stood not 6 feet away, fingering money out of his wallet to pay the cashier for two bags of takeout. As they followed the hostess to their table, Rebecca said, "What was that about? I'm going to have a bruise." "I've seen him before," Jolie said. "What? He's a celebrity or something?" "I saw him this morning in the bank, before we left town." Rebecca glanced back as the man picked up the takeout and exited the restaurant. "He's no one I know." At their booth, as Rebecca and Jolie sat across from each other, the hostess said, "Your waitress will be with you shortly." When they were alone, Jolie said, "He kept looking at me this morning in the bank." "Honey, boys are always staring at you. But even as lovely as you are, he won't have driven 9 hours just to get another look." Always more mature than others her age, now 17, Jolie no longer had any tolerance for being treated like a child. She cocked her head and narrowed her eyes and furrowed her brow. "Mother, don't patronize me." "I'm sorry, dear. I didn't mean to." You've been all mysterious with me about this weird trip in that ridiculous car, and I've stifled myself and not asked, though I've been dying to know if this has something to do with Cora and the Veblen Hotel and all of that horrific shit. Don't use that word, dear. Sorry. All that horrific crap. Anyway, if I do say so myself, I've been an entertaining travel companion under the circumstances. You've been a delight every mile of the way. Jolie looked dubious. There could be an element of sarcasm in that, but I'll give you the benefit of the doubt. Thank you, dear. The thing is, I saw him in the bank. He was filling out a deposit slip, or pretending to fill one out. They'd stopped in the bank to withdraw $4,000 from savings because Luther didn't want them using credit cards during this little exercise, as he called it. Maybe he saw you with all that money, Jolie suggested. In the interest of discretion, Rebecca had not made the withdrawal at a cashier's window. The assistant manager accommodated her at his desk, where no other customers could have heard the transaction. Jolie, the money was given to me in a plain envelope. Nobody could have seen it. During a fuel stop, she had distributed the cash among her handbag, three jacket pockets, and a fanny pack. Besides, you said he was staring at you, and you weren't with me when I got the money. You spent the whole time at that brochure rack, looking through retirement plan options. I hope you're not expecting to retire right out of high school. Maybe I'll create a hugely successful app and be as rich as Croesus by 21, and thereafter live in sybaritic splendor. Reviewing the menu, Rebecca said, I've heard people say that all my life, but I still have no idea who Croesus was. King of Lydia from 560 to 546 BC. He was stinking rich. There was a country named Lydia? A kingdom in West Asia Minor. They didn't teach that in school when I was a girl. They don't teach it now, Mother, or anything useful. Certainly no ancient history or real history. Anything worth knowing I've had to learn on my own, pretty much since fourth grade. The waitress arrived to take their drink order and to recommend the halibut. After ordering, Jolie said, Anyway, that guy didn't have to see what was in your envelope to know what was in it. Rebecca sighed. Couldn't it just be that the man in the bank and the man getting takeout resemble each other a little? Please, Mother, don't sigh me a sigh. Am I a howling hysteric, given to flamboyant flights of fantasy? Nice alliteration. No, you're not, but the guy in the bank looked exactly like this guy, and it's no coincidence that each had the same tattoo around his left wrist. Rebecca put down her menu. A tattoo of what? A creepy snake eating its own tail. Why didn't you mention the tattoo sooner? I wanted to see if I might be believed before I needed to produce the irrefutable piece of evidence. I don't lie, Mom. I know you don't, sweetheart. You never have. Jolie said, A guy doing surveillance from a car has to eat takeout. Two big bags means he's got a partner. Maybe you'll end up a cop like your father. Not a chance. We're living in the age of the new Jacobins and all their thuggish violence. Bad time to be in law enforcement. The Jacobins. That was during the French Revolution. Way to go, Mom. So now what do we do? What indeed, Rebecca thought. Your father will be calling me at 9 o'clock. He'll know what to do. Meanwhile, we might as well have dinner. Super. I saw their cheeseburger coming in. It looked killer. And on the menu here, it says they'll do fries extra crispy if you ask. We who are about to die, stuff our faces. Don't joke about death, Jolie. Wide-eyed with feigned astonishment, Jolie said, But Mother, there's nothing else that's even half as important to joke about. Chapter 10. The ceiling at only 8 feet with its gray acoustic tiles and the concrete walls and the concrete floor and the utter lack of windows, summon in Booth Hendrickson thoughts of crypts and casketed remains and catacombs, in spite of the fluorescent lighting and the arrayed computers. As he waits for the current shift of the resort's security technicians to complete the new task he has given them, he is profoundly nervous, but determined not to appear unsettled. Stacia Odell, unaware that she is an adjusted person, as all of them are unaware, discovers that Hendrickson went without lunch to make this trip. From the restaurant, she orders his favorite tea and a selection of little sandwiches. These fortifications arrive in a timely manner, and Hendrickson surreptitiously takes a maximum-strength acid reducer before sitting down at the wheeled service table to drink and eat in a pretense of nonchalance. Having overseen the conversion of Iron Furnace, he is proud of how the plan was implemented back in the day. He's distraught that Luther Tillman has come here, and he is mystified as to why. The sheriff is a hick, a rube, a hayseed who graduated from a third-tier college, who probably thinks the Ivy League is some women's garden club, who would not be able to get a table in the best Washington restaurants if his life depended on it, a yokel, a boor, whose entire wardrobe probably costs less than one of Hendrickson's suits, not a likely candidate to be a contemporary Sherlock Holmes. Because she has been instructed to have no curiosity about anything Hendrickson does, Stacia Odell makes no inquiry regarding this event planner, Martin Moses, about whom he is so curious. But the security men ask questions as they work. He turns them aside with vague assertions that Moses is engaged in a nefarious scheme on behalf of a corporate rival of Terra Firma, which owns the resort. In this crisis, Hendrickson takes refuge in how smoothly the conversion of Iron Furnace has gone, and in the conviction that it will not be undone by a rustic lump like Luther Tillman. Those citizens employed at the resort had been induced to submit to injections 16 months earlier, when their employer offered free flu vaccinations, and implied that anyone refusing wouldn't be paid for work missed due to influenza. Because these inoculations were also provided free of charge to family members of employees and anyone else in town who wanted them, within 2 weeks, 386 of the 604 residents were programmed with nanomachine command mechanisms. During the next 2 months, those who hadn't been converted in the first wave were, at the most opportune moments, sedated without their knowledge by family members. While sleeping, they were brought into the Fellowship of the Adjusted. Only 7 had a chance to resist, and only 2 had, of necessity, been killed. When everyone in Iron Furnace except children not yet 16 were under Arcadian command, the town became a valued subsidiary of the resort, a single, well-oiled enterprise. Multiple cameras were installed on every street of the town so that nothing might escape the attention of those who owned its people and, by owning them, also owned their property. The video from all those sources can be monitored here in real time if there is any incident, and is stored for 60 days in case a reason subsequently arises to review it. Now, Hendrickson tasks them with discovering where this Martin Moses might have gone in town the previous day after being taken on a tour of the resort by Stacia Odell. 32 minutes into the search, one of the technicians declares, "I've got him." Booth Hendrickson puts down a cucumber sandwich and bolts from his chair to attend the monitor. The feed from a single camera fills the screen. The security man freezes the image, blocks the face, enlarges it. Luther Tillman.
"That's the bastard," Hendrickson confirms.
Back to full image. Recorded at 30 clicks per minute. In the herky-jerky fashion of people moving in video compiled from 2-second bits, Tillman exits a gallery named Bozar and stands on the sidewalk, perhaps thinking that he appears to be a connoisseur when in fact he has small-town, self-righteous, ill-educated sheriff written all over him. He seems to be watching someone. He moves to the curb. He disappears past one of the massive evergreens.
Find him, Hendrickson demands.
In moments, the security tech has the feed from one of the cameras on the farther side of the street, an angled downshot of Tillman looking through the front window of some establishment.
What is that place? Hendrickson asks.
Genovese Ristorante.
Tillman turns from the restaurant. Various cameras capture him as he walks to the end of the block, rounds the corner, goes into an alleyway, and enters the restaurant by a back door.
Why would he do that? Show me an interior.
The tech finds the numbers for the two cameras that cover the public area of the restaurant, specifies date and time. The video appears on a split screen. Tillman enters the room from the kitchen, approaches a waitress, indicates a booth, is escorted to it. Fast forward. Tillman orders. He eats. He leaves. The technician calls up the exterior shot to see where the man went on leaving Genovese. Tillman steps to one of the pembery blue conifers and waits. A woman exits the restaurant. It's not yet twilight, but the overcast and the hour conspire to prevent a clear view of her face. Tillman engages her in conversation. They move away together. He stops at a parked car to retrieve something from the trunk.
Later, enhance that car and get me a license number if you can, Hendrickson says.
Tillman and the woman proceed to a tavern. Wine for her, beer for him. None of the cameras gets a clear view of her face. Fast forward, neither Tillman nor the woman seems interested in drinking. They review some kind of book together. When they get up to leave, she all but directly faces a camera.
Freeze, Hendrickson says.
He stares at the woman. Auburn hair, glasses. He can't see the color of her eyes. She's striking, but she might be anyone. He needs to use Stacia Odell and these three technicians to undertake tasks involving sensitive national security databases that they must not recall having violated, for then they will know him as someone other than the CEO of Terra Firma Enterprises, and they will be agitated. He says,
"Play Manchurian with me."
The four of them respond,
"All right."
From this point forward, everything we do here will not be retained in your memory once I release you. Instead, you will have memories only that we tried and failed to track Martin Moses and this woman once they drove out of town. Do you understand?
Four yeses.
Okay, says Hendrickson. Let's get busy.
He explains how to tap the NSA facial database and apply facial recognition.
Do it.
Chapter 11. Even though the foolishness of its elites had diminished its prospects, and though many among its people lived with the foreboding of terrible loss and tragic withering, this was still a big country in terms of territory and native spirit, so that to drive it was both an exhausting and encouraging experience. By the time they reached Ardmore, Oklahoma, Jane Hawk had found the outer limits of caffeine's ability to counterpunch sleep. She didn't believe a cure had yet been invented for her needle-through-the-temples headache. Sunshine sawed at her eyes, tinnitus as thin and eerie as the cry of something born in an alien world laid down a one-note background to all other sounds. The children, who had slept restlessly en route from Tennessee to Arkansas the previous night, were not in much better shape than Jane, but none of them complained. They took two family-size motel rooms, each with two king-size beds and one rollaway single. The four boys roomed with Luther, the four girls with Jane. From a pizzeria across the street, Luther and Harley fetched takeout for an early dinner, while Jane and Jenny hit the motel vending machines for sodas. Two girls were assigned to each king-size bed. Jane would sleep in the rollaway, her shoulder rig and pistol within easy reach under that narrow bed. As she ate, and as she helped the girls prepare for the night, she yearned for sleep, but didn't worry much about her many enemies. Those in Iron Furnace who had witnessed the extraction of the 8 children were without memories of what they'd seen. She had taken all the usual precautions. She and Luther were in 2 untrackable vehicles. The Tech Arcadians, a crowd as puerile as the name they gave to their insane enterprise, might wonder if she had squeezed from Randall Larkin the facts about Iron Furnace, and if she might have something to do with the disappearance of the kids. They could not be sure, however, and they couldn't know where she had gone. She and Luther and the children would have a long and restful sleep. In the morning, they would set out on an easy 5 or 6 hour drive to Sackett Ranch, west of Austin, where Leland and Nadine would give the children a home, counseling, whatever therapy they needed, and hope. Chapter 12. The massive oak tree at the northwest corner of the rear yard harbored the floors of 12 houses in its great trunk, cabinets aplenty in its larger limbs, doors and lintels and fireplace mantels potential. Standing rooted in the earth, it also provided both shade and a place where the hawks felt they could converse in privacy that perhaps their already built house did not any longer provide. When Ansel returned from Chase Longren's place, he poured 2 glasses of Cabernet and took Claire outside, ostensibly to watch the sunset from the pair of redwood chairs that stood under the tree. The sun swelled as it sank, and the clouds caught fire. Starlings flocked to cavities in the oak and to havens in the eaves of the stables, retreating from the threat of nocturnal raptors. He shared with Claire the news from Chase, and they decided to leave for Leland and Nadine Sackett's place at 3 o'clock in the morning. The ranch hands upon whom Ansel relied lived off-site and did not come to work until 6 o'clock. Juan Saba, the ranch manager, and his wife, Marie, lived here, in a residence 300 yards from the main house, and it was Juan's habit to arise 30 minutes before first light. Ansel and Claire would slip away in the night, with no fear of being trackable, for they would go overland, on horseback. Chapter 13. As if granitized, Hendrickson, for a moment, draws no breath as he stands behind the technician at the workstation. On the large monitor, the screen is divided vertically, and though the 2 faces are beautiful, they are also portraits of menace, versions of that third of the 3 fates, Atropos, who cuts the thread of life. An inspiration for paranoia in many people over the years, Hendrickson succumbs to paranoia of his own. The facial recognition software confirms that the countenance of the woman in the tavern matches, to the millimeter and to the precise degree of angle, each of 28 points of comparison to the on-file image of Jane Hawke, which is the most recent photo taken for her bureau ID. She damn well is a polymorphic virus, as some have called her. Randall Larkin might have been fully broken, might have told her about Iron Furnace. But there were things Larkin didn't know, for the simple reason that he had no need for that information. Within Arcadian circles, details are supposed to be shared solely on a need-to-know basis, just as is the case in official agencies like the CIA. Larkin had no need to know the sentence that accessed the command mechanism in an adjusted person, "Play Manchurian with me," and therefore could not have revealed it to Jane Hawke. However, the cunning bitch has gotten those 4 words. She is now able to take control of any of the adjusted people, not just in Iron Furnace, but wherever she might find them. Hendrickson expels his breath in 2 words spoken as one. Oh, shit. Another thought. If Hawke somehow has learned of the Whispering Room, She can use one of the adjusted people in this town to access all of them and issue a command that they will uniformly obey. What if by phone she tells them to leave Iron Furnace, en masse, tells them to proceed to some authority unlikely to be within the Arcadian sphere of influence, and there announce their enslavement with one voice, or directs them to convene in Times Square or some even more public venue to denounce DJ Michael and insist on the existence of the nanomachine implants that control them. He feels lightheaded and nauseated, as if an ulcerous mass has ruptured, flooding his stomach with blood, leaving his brain starved of oxygen. That she hasn't already done something dramatic with these 600 adjusted people is surely because she has not yet thought of it. Perhaps caught up in the urgent need to free the children and convey them to some safe redoubt, she hasn't had the time or the clarity of mind to realize the power she possesses. There is a way to change the accessing sentence by which the command mechanism is opened for new instructions. Make it something other than play Manchurian with me. But Hendrickson is ignorant of that process because it hasn't been deemed that he needs to know it. "Please excuse me," he says to Stacia Odell and the security technicians, as if he owes their kind courtesy, which he does not. They are of a class far beneath him, and were before being adjusted. They are now at the bottom of any conceivable caste structure. He retreats to a far corner of the bunker to use a phone there. Because of his fumbling fingers, he has to call Eva Kleitner, the director of the lab in Virginia, 3 times before he gets the number correct. The tremor in his voice embarrasses Booth Hendrickson as he urgently conveys to Kleitner the need to use the whispering room to change the accessing sentence as quickly as that can be done, by whatever process it can be accomplished. He speaks frankly because his phone is programmed to scramble his words and hers is capable of unscrambling them. She says, "The good little plebs in Iron Furnace have all had the recent upgrade, the whispering room, so I'll only need about 1.5 hours. "Excellent. But what about all the rest of these plotters? The walking dead on the Hamlet list, the proles in key positions, the Aspasia pumps. They're all over the country. None have had the upgrade. We don't even know yet whether we want them to have the upgrade. That was for the special situation of Iron Furnace. We'll have to contact them 1 at a time to change the access sentence."
"Whatever it takes, it has to be done."
"Even if I put all my trusted people on it, that's going to take weeks."
"Weeks? How many are you talking about?"
"All classes combined? Over 16,000. Because he has known little fear in life, Hendrickson rises above it now. If he is still trembling, it is with anger bordering on rage that an uppity piece of tail like Jane Hawk should by some combination of animal instinct and blind luck have caused them so much grief.
"None of this would be necessary if the cheeky bitch were as dead as she deserves to be."
"Why don't you see to it?"
"I soon will. We're running her down right now. Meanwhile, change the access sentence for the 600 locals here and everyone at the 4 Aspasias. Those are the only adjusted people she knows about. Before she can find another one, she'll either be dead or adjusted herself."
Chapter 14. After dinner, by interior corridors, Rebecca and Jolie Tillman returned to their second-floor room in the Motor Inn. They didn't turn on lights, but guided each other through the darkness to one of the 2 windows, where they parted the blackout draperies to study the parking lot in which earlier they'd left Robbie Stassen's Buick station wagon. "If they tailed us all the way here to Rockford," Rebecca whispered, "they'd be watching the station wagon, but I don't see anyone watching." "If they're experienced at surveillance," Jolie whispered, "then we won't see them right away, unless they're 2 hopeless dickheads."
"That's a word I don't need to hear from you, dear."
Jolie whispered, "What word?"
"You mean hopeless?"
As a Range Rover drove through the parking lot, its headlights briefly bathed a paneled van parked in shadows. The transient wash of light revealed two men in the dark beyond the windshield.
Did you see that, Mom?
I'm afraid I did. Was one of them the guy who bought takeout? I wouldn't bet my sweet butt on it, but from where they're sitting, they have a clear view of that stupid Buick wagon. So I'm inclined to apply Platonism to the issue and say, yes, they're on our case.
Platonism, huh? How does that work?
The truth of the world is ideas, not material things. The two dudes in that van are the current representations of an unchanging and true idea.
What unchanging and true idea?
Evil. They're sleazy criminal scumbags. They've got some kind of bug on the Buick. We can't go anywhere they won't find us. We're toast.
You're right about the bug, dear. But we're not toast.
If we're not toast, Mother, why are we whispering?
Rather than answer the question, Rebecca whispered, Your dad will be calling at 9 o'clock. He'll know what to do.
Yes, but that's 2 hours. What if they come kill us in the meantime?
Why would they follow us all this way just to kill us?
I didn't say just to. They might want to steal all your money, rape us multiple times, and then kill us.
This is a quiet, upscale motor inn, Jolie. All of that would be too noisy.
Not if they have a passkey, tasers, chloroform, and enough self-control not to yell yippee-ki-yay in the act of coitus.
I might not sound like it, Mom, but I'm scared.
Rebecca had been trying not to alarm her daughter, but she had arrived at the conclusion that the man with the snake tattoo was one of the men in the van, and that it was best to give that duo the slip sooner rather than later. Although Luther had told her nothing specific on the phone the previous night, he'd made it clear that what happened at the Veblen Hotel was part of something far bigger, and that merely because he had been doing what any good officer of the law ought to be doing, not only he, but also his family, were in imminent danger. He had anticipated some smaller threat as early as Friday, when that loathsome Booth Hendrickson came to the house, and it was now 3 nights since, on Sunday, he had risked taking 2 disposable phones from the evidence locker so that they could avoid wiretaps yet stay in touch while he was in Kentucky. Rebecca had made the mistake of leaving the Buick unattended while she and Jolie were in the bank, which was no doubt when a battery-powered transmitter had been planted on the vehicle. There was no way to find the device and remove it while the men in the van watched. When Luther phoned her in 2 hours, he would surely tell her to forget the Buick and leave the 2 thugs running surveillance on an abandoned car. No need to wait for him to call or to call him now.
Applied Platonism, Rebecca said, tells me that we need to scoot.
They had not unpacked before going to dinner. They helped each other through the darkness, bumping against furniture in a graceless urgency that under other circumstances would have inspired giggling, and retrieved their coats from the bed and located their luggage in the alcove outside the bathroom. With 2 suitcases and a makeup case, they eased out the door into the corridor. The rooms on the farther side of the hall looked out onto a south side parking lot different from the one to the north in which they had left the Buick. Wordless and impatient, they rode the slow elevator to the ground floor. They left the building by a south door and walked through 3 rows of parked vehicles toward the street, their breath in rapid cadence pluming, the night cold, and all the city sounds shrill and brittle. The motor inn stood in a busy commercial area, and they kept the building between them and the men in the van as they made their way to a street. Along a sidewalk, past retail shops, some open and others closed, past bars and restaurants, from a few of which came live music of an insistent gaiety without real gladness, mother and daughter went in search of another place to stay the night. Rebecca was relieved they had taken the initiative, but on Jolie's face, and surely on her own, was written the expectation that safety and a place to stay were different things, the latter easy to find, The former, elusive. Chapter 15. Hendrickson, in the bunker of the fates, at all times striking a confident and commanding pose, although he periodically feels as if something is sliding loose inside his chest, and at all times as if he is poised on a wire above the upturned faces of everyone he has ever known, while they wait in gleeful expectation of his fall. 20 minutes earlier, the security technician tasked with enhancing the image of Luther Tillman's parked car clarified the license plate number. The Chevrolet is a rental obtained from a concession at the Louisville airport on Monday. Now the tech swivels in his workstation chair and says to Hendrickson,
"According to the rental agency, sir, the Chevy was returned to the airport just a short while ago, at 5:30.
Airports are monitored by more cameras per cubic foot than any other facilities in the country. Hendrickson tells the tech how to backdoor the NSA's video coordination program and get an image of whoever dropped off that car in Louisville. Jane Hawk had taken the precaution of parking her car in a residential neighborhood, a block and a half from the main drag in Iron Furnace, where she assumed there was no camera. By following multi-camera video of her when she departed the tavern with the sheriff, a second technician is able to track her and identify her vehicle as a black Ford Escape. When she drives to Lakeview Road and Tillman follows her in his rental, her license plate is clear as she passes through a well-lighted intersection. Hendrickson considers putting a description of the car and its license plate number on the National Crime Information Center's network, flashing it to every law enforcement agency in the country. But he hesitates. He suspects the bitch knows how to tap the NCIC without flagging herself, that from time to time she checks to learn if they have any additional crucial information about her. If she discovers they know her car and the plate number, she'll switch the tags, which are probably stolen, for another stolen pair, and as soon as she can, she'll dump the Ford Escape. Nationwide, police cruisers and other government vehicles, equipped with 360-degree license plate scanning systems, collect numbers from vehicles around them, parked and in motion, minute by minute, and transmit those readings to regional archives around the clock. The NSA maintains the central archive for all these systems. If at any time since they left Iron Furnace, the Ford Escape or the rental Chevy has been scanned, the NSA program will be able to tell him where and when. Although no less on edge than before, Hendrickson tells himself that it is a great time to be alive for men like him, when they have the ability, legally or otherwise, to gaze on the world with the infinite eyes of a god. Chapter 16. Sitting bundled in a chilly van because the exhaust vapor might draw attention to them, having eaten cold takeout, breathing stale air redolent of garlic and Beetle's body odor and his occasional cigarette. Clandestine work in the service of a worthy ideal, when the righteousness of the mission is more important than anything the laws of man and nature forbid. When one has a license to kill, and will do so not for love of country like James Bond, but for a much greater cause, like the transformation of the world into a far less chaotic place and the preservation of the environment by strictly controlling the destructive impulses of humanity. Well, to most people, such work seems meaningful, rich with romance and mystery and adventure, a thrill a minute. Hassan Zaghari, who yearns for the new world coming and who has killed for it on numerous occasions, who has known great adventure, who understands the concept of romance but prefers impersonal sex, who sees ignorance and confusion everywhere in the world but no mystery, wishes that his work were more like the general public's perception of it. In the movies, all is glamour. The hero never must endure a partner who is an odor machine like Kernan Beetle, and guys on stakeout never have to urinate behind a dumpster on a freezing night in order to remain close to their vehicle if they suddenly need to roll. At the moment, Beetle slouches behind the steering wheel, talking nonstop about something in which Hassan has zero interest, while Hassan sits with his laptop in the position for which it's named. He has hacked the computer system at the headquarters of the corporation that owns this motor inn and hundreds of others. Their HQ is in the enviable climate of Orlando, Florida, and has routed back to the computer in this Rockford unit, where he now monitors their electronic key system. Many hotels and motor inns have long ago replaced basic lock sets with electronic locks and have issued magnetic key cards instead of traditional keys because this allows them to change the lock combination on a room each time a new guest checks in. The upgraded key card program at this establishment monitors every use of every card and every opening and closing of every door to a guest room. Ostensibly, to be alerted if an illegal electronic device other than a card is used to disengage a lock. A card has an electronic signature different from that of any device favored by burglars, and for other security reasons. On Hassan's laptop screen, rows of numbered squares represent guest rooms in the motor inn. A red square signifies a locked door. When a key card is used, the square turns green until the door is closed and locks again automatically. A blue square indicates a door that has been opened from inside by an exiting guest, and it remains blue until the door closes and locks, whereupon it turns red again. In the motor inn's computerized registry, Rebecca Tillman's name is linked to room 212. When mother and daughter return from dinner in the restaurant, the red square signifying 212 turns green, and then red.
"They're back," Hassan says.
Beetle interrupts himself in the middle of expounding on whatever tedious issue currently fascinates him.
"Why no lights?"
The women's second-floor room is on this side of the building, pretty much directly above where they parked the ancient Buick station wagon. They have two windows, and both remain dark. After half a minute, Beetle says,
"Something isn't right."
The van is well back from the building, in the comparatively shadowed area between pools of light from two parking lot lamps. Hassan picks up a pair of binoculars from the seat beside him and focuses on one of 212's windows, then on the other.
"They've parted the drapes, in the dark," he says, "one face above the other, looking out." "At us?"
Beetle wonders.
"At something."
A Range Rover cruises toward them, past them, washing the van with its headlights, and a moment later, the drapes at the window in 212 fall shut.
"I think they saw us," Hassan says. "How would they know even to look for us? I should have gone in there for takeout," Hassan says. "Maybe one of them saw you this morning in the bank." "Who could know we'd cross paths?"
Hassan had wanted to do the food run, but Beetle didn't trust anyone to order dinner for him. As is often the case, Beetle now feels it necessary to announce the obvious.
"The room's still dark."
Hassan puts down the binoculars and studies the display of red squares on the laptop screen.
"They're doing something in the dark," says Beetle.
After a minute, the square signifying room 212 turns from red to blue. Able to view the screen from an angle, seeing this development, Beetle says,
"They're leaving the room."
The blue square goes red, and Beetle starts the van's engine. Closing the laptop, putting it aside, opening his door, Hassan says,
"I don't think they'll go for the Buick. They'll probably split from the other side of the building. I'll tail them on foot." "I'll keep my phone on," Beetle says.
With a faint note of exasperation that he can't repress, Hassan says,
"Yes, that would be the way to do it."
He gets out into the bitter night and hurries toward the motor inn, eyes watering as the icy air prickles him. The two women have never seen him before. He is experienced in the craft of tailing suspects on foot while remaining invisible to them. He hates the freezing cold. He was born for warmth. But a March night in Rockford is the least of the things he has endured to help bring to fruition the better world in which people like this mother and daughter will know their place and will keep to it, or otherwise forfeit their existence. Chapter 17. In Ardmore, Oklahoma, in the motel room dimly lighted by one lamp draped with a towel, where the four exhausted young girls lay as stone still as if sedated, Jane hoped for dreamless sleep. But alone on the rollaway bed, she melted into worlds conjured by the unconscious. She wandered a menacing nightscape of city streets, searching for Nick, every resident a hostile, somnambulant figure of shadowy substance. And then she was in an infinite factory and could not find her way out of a maze of abandoned machinery and decades of trash from which Randall Larkin was repeatedly resurrected and borne toward her on a tide of rats. And then a sniper on a hilltop fired down into a plain across which a great herd of horses stampeded, the shot animals screaming when wounded and tumbling in ghastly mists of blood and billowing dust, Jane on foot among the frantic rush of horses, searching for something in the tumult, the horses having become ponies, Exmoor ponies, and ahead of her came a shape upon the hoof-beaten ground, the shape of some rider shot from the saddle and fallen and trampled and rendered ragged. And she was almost able to identify the torn and broken rider seen through the dust, was almost able to see him, approaching through the chaos, approaching the rider, perpetually approaching. Chapter 18. Hendrickson revels in the data from the NSA. West. The vicious bitch and the yokel sheriff went south from Iron Furnace into Tennessee late Tuesday and then turned west. At 2:28 and 14 seconds a.m. Wednesday, 9 miles east of Memphis, an eastbound Tennessee Highway Patrol car had read the front plates of the Ford Escape in the westbound lanes. At 2:28 and 17 seconds, it read the plates of the Chevy close behind the Ford. The next catch is southwest of Little Rock. An Arkansas Highway Patrol car, entering Interstate 30, automatically scanned the front plates of the Ford Escape on the adjacent exit ramp to Hot Springs at 4:36 and 24 seconds a.m. Wednesday, and the rental Chevy 3 seconds later. It is a mystery to Hendrickson how Hawk and Tillman know each other and why they hooked up in Iron Furnace. Now a new mystery weaves its web with the first one. What do they want in Hot Springs or someplace beyond? Are they gone to ground there? Or are they traveling henceforth off the interstates? In cities and major suburbs and on interstate highways, the automatic license reading program is better established than it is in rural areas on smaller federal, state, and county roads. Therefore, this promising pursuit leads to sudden disappointment when the security technician reports that no additional reading of the Ford's license plate has occurred since the one at Hot Springs, Arkansas, more than 16 hours earlier. 2 readings of the rental Chevy took place subsequent to Hot Springs, the first at 8:06 a.m., where I-30 melded with I-40 on the perimeter of Little Rock, the second at 2:25 p.m., 3 miles north of Nashville on Interstate 65. Somebody had been driving it back to the Louisville airport, where it had been returned just a little while ago, at 5:30. And now, the third technician, seeking an airport video image of the person who returned the car to Louisville, strikes the jackpot. Except that the man on the monitor, shown at the rental return lot, is white rather than black, not Luther Tillman. Considering his tangled mane of hair and mountain man beard and sunglasses, not enough of him is visible to bother processing him with facial recognition software. On the screen, he walks out of camera range. There is no video of the vehicle in which he might have departed. Hendrickson is wrought by rough emotions, anger foremost among them, and by a sense that people he relies on have failed him, not least of all, Huey Darnell up there in Minnesota. Stepping away from the security technicians and Stacia Odell, who remain accessed and entirely in his control as they wait for further instructions, Hendrickson calls Huey's iPhone.
Darnell, says Darnell.
It's me. Where are you?
Running surveillance on Tillman.
The sheriff?
Yeah. Luther Tillman.
Where is he? Hendrickson asks.
In his house. His wife and daughter, though. They left town in Deputy Stassen's old Buick wagon. Hassan Zaghari and Kernan Beadle are on the case. Have them under watch at a motel in Rockford.
Rockford where? Hendrickson asks.
Illinois. They drove a long day to get there. We don't know why, Rockford.
Maybe they're going to meet Luther.
Well, but he's right here in his house.
Is that so? Darnell is silent. Then,
he was, earlier.
Until he flew to Kentucky on Monday. This is Wednesday, so I guess, yes, he was there earlier. 2 days earlier. Huey Darnell chooses silence again.
You know what I want you to do, Darnell.
I guess I should go into the house here.
Brilliant. You go into the house there and you take the place apart, top to bottom. You look for anything that explains why Luther went to Iron Furnace, Kentucky. You got that?
Yes, sir.
You look for anything that indicates he's ever interacted with Jane Hawke, ever knew her, or knew someone else who knew her. You know who Jane Hawke is?
Yes, sir. Everybody knows.
You look for anything else that seems curious. You don't sleep until you've found something that helps me.
What if there's nothing to find? I come up empty.
That's not an option, Hendrickson says.
The wife and daughter left lights on all through the house.
So?
Well, so it looked like someone was there. Now it's dark.
Are you making an excuse for yourself?
No, sir. Just saying.
Hendrickson terminates the call and stands fuming. He wants to believe every Arcadian is at least a cut above the hoi polloi, but just because a man's ideology is correct doesn't mean he has what it takes to deserve the better world he envisions. Soon, Huey Darnell will have to be injected with the control mechanism used for those on the Hamlet list and sent away somewhere to kill himself. Now, Hendrickson returns to the security technicians waiting with Stacia Odell, and he instructs them to back out of the sites they have illegally hacked at his direction. Then he reminds them that they are to remember only that they have been seeking to learn where Martin Moses, the corporate espionage specialist, went after he left the resort the previous day. That done, he closes down access to their control programs by saying, Auf Wiedersehen. Goodbye, they say in unison, and return to their regular security duties as if nothing unusual has occurred. Stacia Odell says, Is there somewhere more you wish to go, Mr. Congreve? She has worked long past her usual quitting time, but there is something more he needs before she takes him back to the helicopter, still waiting on the outskirts of town.
Let's go to your office, Ms. Odell.
The night concierge has his own office. In Ms. Odell's suite, the reception lounge is dark, her assistant gone for the day. They proceed into her office, where Hendrickson closes the door and says,
Play Manchurian with me.
All right, she says, and is again accessed.
Stand right there, he directs, and take off your clothes.
Although her face remains placid, perhaps the equivalent of a frown passes through her eyes, but then she begins by unbuttoning her blouse. Booth Hendrickson sits in one of the plush chairs for visitors. With his smartphone, he places a call to the after-hours number of Marshall Ackerman,
a director of the nonprofit Volunteers for a Better Tomorrow, which is one of DJ Michael's projects. When Ackerman answers, Hendrickson explains the situation with the Ford Escape, last seen in Hot Springs. If they left those 8 kids somewhere in Arkansas, she and Tillman need only one vehicle now. She's probably still driving the Ford. Put somebody inside the NSA program.